Views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guests, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Community Radio and Acorn Community Enterprises, or the underwriters of this station. Hello, and welcome to Dig This Trump Watch with host Professor Parker Pollack. Hello, Professor Pollack.
Hello, Pamela.
Trump Watch airs the first Saturday of each month at 9 a.m. I am Pamela Spoto, and also in the studio is Craig Boyer. Hi, Craig.
Good morning.
And we'll be joining, both of us will be joining in the discussion. And Professor Pollack, we always have a lot to talk about when on this show, and the list just gets longer and longer. And I know that you had said that you would like to talk about, have the major theme for today be Donald Trump's concept of America's greatness yesterday, today, and tomorrow. His idea of make America great again. And then you had suggested that as time allows, we could talk about North Korea, tax reform, and Trump's obsessive nature. So, Professor Pollack, where would you like to begin? We have so many possibilities and so many things to talk about.
Well, I think we should probably pay tribute to the frail little lady who refused to give up her seat in 1955 in Birmingham, Alabama, December 1st. We all know Rosa.
Yeah. Yes, okay. We do. Hooray for Rosa Parks.
Yep. So that was really very effective way of getting a bus boycott, because then the black people in Birmingham just wouldn't ride the bus. They found other ways to get to
That's
work.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. Very telling years.
I think we need a global boycott right now. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So, when we take a look at greatness in the way that Donald Trump has talked about it, I get the impression that for him, greatness means power, whether it's him being a great president. I get the impression that he appreciates other world leaders who are more authoritarian and more dictator-like than the past presidents of the United States have been. I say this because of his reactions to the fellow who is in Turkey, the fellow who's leading the Philippines,
yes,
the fellow who's leading Russia. He seems to admire those kinds of leaders. And so greatness, I think, at least tentatively, he hasn't been in office a year yet, but so far it looks to me like Donald Trump equates greatness in his personal life and in the national existence with power.
That is a really interesting point, because when I think about when was America great, you know, I'm thinking about different variables that would be included into that particular time, that particular era. But the notion that it is about power and being powerful as an individual or a country, that puts a whole different spin on it, doesn't it? Yes.
Right. Well, once you leave the individual, in this case, once you leave Donald Trump and move to the larger idea of the nation, when was the nation great, then you have to come up with some kind of a guideline or some kind of discriminators to figure out what you're going to use for indications of that. And so if we just extend the personal metaphor from Donald over to the nation, there are times when the United States, certainly separating from England, has to be a big deal. You know, when those guys put their life on the line, signing the Declaration,
yes,
then writing, and, you know, maybe at some point down the road, we might want to take a look at what they wrote in the way of a U.S. Constitution and whether the people were to be included or not.
That is an excellent idea, because as you were saying that, I was wondering about what was it that they really had in mind, their ideology at that time. And yet you're perfectly correct in saying that this was a time of upheaval, and they did put their lives on the line.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So the dilemma for selecting a particular period of time when the U.S. was great, there are always going to be some elements that are going to be detractors. We had the eras of slavery, 100 years of Jim Crow, 100 years of segregation. We had I guess the genocidal treatment of the American Indian.
Yes.
And so these threads also run along the development of the working class or slave labor, so to speak, wage slaves, best exemplified by our guy Andy. Andrew Carnegie was a perfect example of a fellow in business, Steele. He learned that it was much cheaper to go to Ireland and Scotland, get some new workers, bring them over here, build them some housing to stay in. When they get old and sick and can't work, then you kick them out of the housing and go get some more people. Now, that's much better, dollars and cents-wise, than having to buy people, as in the case of the South with the plantations and having to buy the slaves. So you've got that the beginnings then during the industrialization process of the development of people who have nothing involved in the economic system except their time. And the jobs that they have to do usually developed or counted on their strength and usually counted on them being men. And so that whole industrialization process culminates, for me anyway, when the system coughed and choked in the 1930s, and we finally realized that you can be out of work through no fault of your own. When the system gets sick and ejects 25% of the labor force, you can't hardly expect a person to, remember the old phrase, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Now, certainly some people did make it through the Depression from 1929 to Pearl Harbor, to December 1941. Some people didn't make it through, and it seems the stats really make it look like the ones who made it through had access to farming. They had access to a way to feed themselves and to exchange goods, since there wasn't the money supply shrank like crazy. And so there are people, if you talk to them during those years, who said, we didn't have any money. We didn't use money. It was a barter kind of a system. So. Yeah.
It is so interesting because I saw something, well, I'm going to mention social media, and I reposted it because it was by a Native American who said, if it may come to the point, if you don't know how to plant, you will not be able to eat. If you don't know how to raise food, you will not be able to eat. Mm-hmm. And I think that is really, really important because we have lost, a lot of us have lost that ability growing our own food. And that is basic. Mm-hmm. That is basic. Sure. And something else that you said as you were going along in terms of greatness, you know, the great era of the United States. And I guess I would ask, well, what that brings up from the way you describe it is great for whom? Because when you did have slavery and when you had the genocidal warfare on Native Americans, it was making things great, quote unquote, for the white male who had money.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
And so that is just inane.
Yeah, there's a book out, I can't remember the author's name, but it has to do with the genocidal treatment of California Indians. And for those like me who was, and well, I'm not sure about you guys, or I was born and raised in California, and so there's parts of that book that ring about my history of living here. So anyway, it's a pretty interesting book, and I wouldn't, it's pretty sad because it develops the stories about Native Americans being really abused. It's just incredible. So anyway, we have that thread then of the industrialization process, which is in England starting in the 1770s. Over here it was 100 years later. So you've got that period of time here where you're developing the working class male, or the working class, let's say. Wage slavery, as some people refer to it, and then that, like I mentioned, culminating with the Depression, and the system got sick and didn't have room for people. So, where are we then? I mean, I think since Donald Trump talks about the middle class, I'm not sure he understands how many different varieties there are, ways of defining the middle class, but he talks a lot about that, and so for me. You could, if you wanted to define the middle class the way mathematicians or statisticians would, you would say, well, you take the median plus or minus two standard deviations and blah, 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 and you'd have 60% of the population. Well, let's not do that. What the way I like to think about the middle class is going back to when it began, which is in that period following World War II. For me, there was no middle class in America until after the war ended. And because at that point, all kinds of options were now open. And we began to experience the idea that women don't have to necessarily stay in the house. During the war, they worked. So it was really a really very productive time. And so for me then, the middle class, if you want to talk about it in terms of dollars today, I would say anywhere from $40,000 to $90,000 for a household. The median income in the United States per household right now is about close to $60,000, $55,000, $60,000. So you can put a dollar number on it if you want to, which most people do. And so another way to think about it is take a look at a household, let's say children. What are the options really that the children have access to in school? What kinds of schools do they have? Do the schools prepare them for college? Do they grow up with a future that's really endearing? And then take a look at the options for the adults in that household as far as their careers and all of that. And you can come up with some idea of what a really neat situation would be. Call that middle class. So, pardon me. So, but most people, I think for Donald, he probably sticks with the idea of the money. So when you take a look then at the middle class developing starting in 1945 in this country, pardon me, the gas ran out of the system about 1975. And so it's very easy in the literature to find people who talk about the golden years, 1945 to 1975, that 30-year period when things were just great. Well, I think one of the reasons that is difficult to automatically accept the fact that 1945 to 75 were the great years, as Pamela mentioned before, great for adult white males, certainly. And we can get down to the characteristics of that 30-year period, but in order to understand it, for me, I have to go back to the Depression, to that 1929 to 1941 period, when all kinds of things happened in this country. The first thing I think I've already mentioned, people realized that you can be out of work through no fault of your own. And there were all kinds of programs that were begun in the 1930s that set the stage for making, you know, for the great America of the 30 years from 45 to 75. Unemployment insurance, wealth, aid to families with dependent children, aid to the needy disabled, aid to the needy blind, old age assistance, the Fair Labor Standards Act, which gave us overtime pay and the 40-hour week. A lot of times, in fact, I have a shirt that says, appreciate unions, they gave you the weekend. Well, the Fair Labor Standards Act really gave us the weekend, but unions put a lot of pressure on the... And during the 1930s also, unions became legal in this country. If by union, and this is what I mean by union, a group of people with a shared interest who get together to bargain collectively with the employer, and all the while lying in the background is a threat of a strike. That for me is what a union is. And that was illegal in this country until 1935.
And it's so interesting because the beginnings of the union, I mean, that was so difficult. It was almost like women getting the right to vote in certain ways. People were killed. They were called communists. They were brutalized, these people that were trying to organize for fair labor practices. And, you know, during this 30-year period, I do want to say, too, that, you know, we hear about the glass ceiling, and it goes back to who was it great for? I mean, overall, I guess it could trickle down from the white male, right, to the white woman. But there was the glass ceiling where the man, I mean, what? The woman was making like 50 cents to every dollar a man made. Mm-hmm. There were certain jobs that women were not allowed to have. So it is very curious. And after the war, the GI Bill that allowed people to buy homes and so forth, as I understand it, that wasn't as available to African Americans. Mm-hmm. And then right. there was the redlining aspect of banks not loaning to certain groups of people. So it's very curious.
Yeah.
But I agree that that's an interesting period of time, that 30-year aspect, that 30-year era. So it is curious.
Well, so when you get to 1945, the end of World War II, you've got all these programs in place so that now as the American economy begins to develop then throughout this 30-year period, when it coughs and chokes and sputters and has trouble making room for everyone, so to speak, there are the social safety net was in place to provide some kind of support for people in the system when things weren't working out, completely for everyone. And in Europe, they also were developing the same kind of a social safety net. It's just in the case of Europe, they were so heavily bombed and destroyed during the war that when they began to rebuild, they were trying to also keep the Soviet Union from creeping ever further west. Poland fell and Hungary fell and Czechoslovakia fell and so forth. East Germany fell. So there was that threat. And the United States, England, and Western Europe were sort of working through NATO to provide some sort of an economic system in Europe that would support the population and keep the population from looking towards another kind of a system, like communism. Yeah, right, Craig. Looking towards communism as a way to do things rather than capitalism. And so given that, they began with the coal and steel community, which led to the common market, which led to the European Union, which led to what we see today. And along the way, one of the things that happened was the United States through NATO and England and Western Europe agreed that they had to provide a social safety net for their people to keep them from being attracted to communism, mm-hmm. as Craig mentioned. So what was in that social safety net? Well,
healthcare.
Healthcare. Yeah. Name some. Yeah. Healthcare.
The 40-hour week, that kind of thing.
Yes, right.
All kinds of social security.
Retirement
planning.
Yes.
Provision for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Retirement, sick leave, mm-hmm. Vacation.
Extensive vacations.
Yes.
Much greater than what we have here in this country.
Maybe 7 weeks in the case.
What about something like unemployment insurance if you get laid off or something like that?
All of those things, right. So when you take a look at the health care provided there, it started out as a government program. Education started out as a government program. Child care started out as a government program. Unemployment insurance, retirement, sick leave, all of these things began as government programs. And while here in the United States, we had some of those things with unemployment insurance and aid to families with dependent children, but when it came to health care, we relied on the employer. And that's one of the reasons why we have such a difficult system today is that we're relying on the employers to provide health insurance for people. So, while in Europe they began with it coming through taxation providing the government with the money to provide health care and all those other things. So,
and I would like to remind our listeners that this is KKRN.org, Community Radio, Round Mountain, Bella Vista, and we are all volunteers and we are listener supported. And if you just tuned in, we are listening to Dig This Trump Watch with Professor Parker Pollack. And right now, we're in the process of talking about America's greatness via Donald Trump's view. And also certain time periods when there were safety net programs that were initiated in the United States and in Europe. So it's really very fascinating, Professor Pollack.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you. It has been fascinating for me over the years watching these things develop, especially when you get to this period, the 30 years that maybe Donald thinks is great, and a lot of other people who've looked at it think the 30-year period from 45 to 75 were the great years. And like we've already mentioned, it wasn't great for everyone. During that period of time, we had riots. I mean, it was a time of protest. It was the women's movement began, free speech on campuses, prisoner rights, welfare rights, the AIM movement, American Indian movement. So there were various groups who were saying, wait a minute.
What about us?
Yes.
You know, I mean, in terms of equality, it can't just be, you know, this one group of people.
Bunch of white guys, and that's it.
that get all of the benefits here. What about us? Yeah. You know, we're part of America. We help make America be what it is, especially us, you know.
Yeah, there were. It was just like from probably, let's see, it began with civil rights. Where black people insisted on the right to vote. Can you imagine that?
Yeah.
It took a long time. 100 years after the end of the Civil War, and here we're passing, you know, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and 5. That was a long period of time. So
yes,
we might want to put that on the plus side, something that happened during the period. But we also had a president who had to resign in shame. His vice president Spiro Agnew had to resign for
corruption
charges while he was the governor of Maryland.
That's correct.
So. That's 1973. The vice president resigns. 1974, the president resigns because of the Watergate scandal.
Yes.
1975, the final troops leave Vietnam. And so that period there from 1945 to 75 is rife with a lot of different elements that we might not want to put down on the plus side. We had various forms of, you know, retraining programs, one thing that didn't happen in this country, which did happen in Europe, when an economy or an industry would begin to advance, and so it needed fewer workers through automation, that the existing workers who were going to get laid off would have a training program provided by the process of automating the factory, that the corporation would take advantage of the extra money they were going to make and provide retraining, along with government help for the workers. And typically, we don't do that in the United States.
Well, can I ask you a question, Professor Pollack? And this has to do with something that you said in a past show, and it really was truly amazing. I mean, I know that automation and robotics is a very big thing, you know, in the United States now, the development of that. But I truly thought that part of the reasons that people were suffering in terms of employment or unemployment in the U.S. was that manufacturing went overseas, jobs were sent overseas. But as I recall, what you said was that something like 80%, we've lost 80% of the jobs due to automation.
Right.
And that's not talked about in terms of economics today. All we hear is, the jobs went overseas.
Yeah.
Manufacturing went overseas.
Well, I think President Trump likes to say that.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And all of his products, I was watching the show on MSNBC, and they went through a huge list of all the things that he sells. And every one of them was made overseas, and they gave a rundown of what they where they're made. Not a one was made in the United States.
Boy,
what a hypocrite!
Yeah.
And maybe that's why Trump says this is fake news. When the truth comes out, it's fake. It's fake. Fake news. Fake news.
Yeah, right. Well, in America first, which is an old phrase that has a lot of really nasty
connotations
from World War II. At any rate, So that period from 1945 to 1975, we get the development of the middle class, we get rising incomes, we have, you know, kind of the leave it to Beaver programs, My Three Sons, and the sitcoms on TV that entertain people.
And those shows showed or depicted what we consider to be the traditional family, the nuclear family. The husband works, the wife is in her apron, she stays. She stays at home. She cooks. She takes care of the children.
And she even has pearls around her neck.
Yes, and she's dressed in a skirt and pearls, and she serves the dinner. And that is just not, that is what those shows are depicting during that period of time, especially in the 50s.
Yeah.
So you want to go back to the 50s. Is that what people would like to see?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and if you took a look at the people that you knew when you during the 50s when those programs were on TV, son of a gun, in families that I grew up in, kind of a middle class family, and the kids I ran around with were all very similar middle class kids, and son of a gun, if our mothers looked like June Cleaver, I'm not kidding. It was uncanny.
And yeah. And what was so strange about that, and you're right, Professor Pollack, and I'm thinking about my mother and my stepfather, and the idea, though, was that paid work was valued. Unpaid work was not valued. And it's, mm-hmm. And there, I don't think there's anything wrong with one of the people staying at home, husband or wife, and tending to the home. That's a huge job. You have a garden. You cook the meals. You do the laundry. You clean the house. You take care of the kids. You go to the cleaners. Mm-hmm. All of those mm-hmm. things that make life easier so that your partner can be the breadwinner. But that was devalued.
Mm-hmm. Right, right, yeah.
And my mother worked so hard doing right. all those things.
And even when you take a look today, economists still haven't developed a way. Well, a couple of guys, but for the most part, if you look at an econ textbook for college course, micro or macro, you'll find in there one of the things they like to talk about is statistics and how much does a country produce in a year, the gross domestic product of goods and services. The services of the stay-at-home, if it's in most cases woman, the stay-at-home woman is not included in those statistics. And there have been a lot of estimates about how large gross national product or gross domestic product would be if you included
it. And yeah. isn't it interesting? I don't know why I thought of this. I thought about a former governor of California, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and his wife, who also they both worked, so they hired. They hired help to do all of those mm-hmm, things. He also mm-hmm. had an affair with the hired help, but you know, so there's an economy there. That's for mm-hmm. sure.
Sure.
And it takes
oh, yeah.
a lot of work to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So yeah, once you hire it out, then it's you know if yeah. you have
then it's valuable.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you have a farm and you have six kids, and the kids are all doing farm work. They're not included in the national statistics as far as services are concerned, unless you pay them an allowance and report it somehow on your taxes. Well, when we take a look then at the period 1945 to 1975, it did have a few glitches. It wasn't all the golden years. And so, in addition to I had one other note about. One of our presidents during that period, 1968, during the middle of the Vietnam War, the president of the United States announced to us March 30th or something, 1968, I will not run again. Lyndon Johnson gave advance notice to the Democratic Party that don't nominate me because I'm not going to run. And so Hubert Humphrey, the vice president, then went ahead and got the job, was nominated in the Chicago Convention of 1968, which is, in itself is nothing to be proud of if you go back and look mm-hmm. at some of the film of what happened outside the convention hall.
The protesters, yes.
Oh, yeah. So, and so you've got Hubert Humphrey then going ahead and taking the job of being running in the 68 against Nixon, and he had to promise not to criticize Lyndon Johnson's conduct of the war, or not to criticize the Vietnam War, not to talk about getting out of Vietnam, an honorable way to, you know, reduce our effort there. And that sort of the same thing, I saw it have, the Democrats did it again to Hillary, that I got the impression that she wasn't to criticize Barack Obama in her campaign. She didn't talk about the things that happened during the campaign that might have been done differently. And so I referred to it in those during the election as the Hubert Humphrey effect. Well, it came back to haunt.
That's good.
Hillary. Yeah, so anyway, we made it through the golden years to 1975, and then things started falling apart. And we haven't figured out how to put the, what is that, Humpty Dumpty?
Oh, put it back together
again. We haven't figured out how to put the thing back together again. So starting about in the 1970s, in the mid 1970s, you find that wages began to increase slower than the cost of living. And that's been going on since 1975. The average wage earner in America, the real income, that is income adjusted for inflation, the real income of the average American worker has been descending constantly since 1975. There was a little blip, a little increase somewhere there in the late Clinton years, early Bush Jr. years. There was a little blip where it went up. But still, the rule is the real income of the average American worker has been descending. And so you find that puts a lot of pressure on a household to have everybody in the household working is one of the things that happens. And part of the dilemma was that if you look back during the golden years, one of the things that happened during the golden years was that corporations in the North looked to places to move their companies inside the United States that didn't have unions. And so they moved south. They moved south into the southern states, and then eventually they started moving to Mexico and to China. And so you do have some jobs, maybe of all the jobs that we've lost since 1945, the calculation was made about 15% of them have been due to overseas companies getting the work. So at any rate, you have that problem where the corporation is looking for another place with cheaper labor. That also began in that period. And automation picked up. I mean, it wasn't just, you know, that the techno period, the high-tech period in the late 90s.
Yes.
There was an earlier one in the late 70s when also automation began to hit the assembly lines. And so that also had an effect, big effect, on doing away with jobs. And there was no bargaining over the consequences of that. There was no union to represent. The unions began to fall by the wayside.
They certainly were attacked, I mean, and dismantled, it seems to me, in terms of the unions. I mean, it's just really incredible. There aren't that many unions left, percentage-wise.
Mm-hmm.
And, for example, maybe that's another reason that this administration, one of the many reasons this administration doesn't like academia, because there are strong unions.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, what about those teachers? And, you know, what about that? And what about this? You know, we should do away with unions. And that is what has protected the people,
mm-hmm.
and protected mm-hmm. wages and protected jobs. And maybe later on in the show, I know I was listening to Joseph Stiglitz, mm-hmm. an economist. I guess I didn't know that he won the Nobel Prize.
Yeah.
And he was saying that at this time, he was talking about tax reform, and it's not tax reform at all, mm-hmm. but that this is the highest inequality that we're seeing now in our history. And I don't know whether that's exactly true.
There's some support for that. The other version of that I heard was since 1929.
And that could be since 1929. So as you're mentioning about jobs, you know, this process of corporations moving jobs to non-union states, of moving them to other countries, of automation happening, it's all about not treating people fairly and equitably and just pay them what they're worth so we can mm-hmm. have this mm-hmm. this solid middle class and have everybody in the middle class, really. And then they would be able to more able to buy those products that those mm-hmm. corporations make.
Yeah.
It doesn't make sense to me unless we just want to continue the war machine. And that's going to drive our economy, right?
Well, that's one of the things that happened to us back in the golden years when Europe and Japan and England were rebuilding their economies. They were rebuilding their factories with the latest stuff, the mm-hmm. latest equipment. They were very efficient.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you have happening there are two things. One, our factories weren't bombed and destroyed, and so we didn't get a chance to, weren't forced to rebuild them with the latest stuff all of a sudden. So we lost a competitive edge a little bit there. And at the same time, we took on the role of protecting the rest of the world from the Soviet Union. The Cold War drained money out of our government's budget that could have gone to all these things we see in the European safety net. We could have had health care.
Does this seem harsh? In my opinion, it's almost like protecting the rest of the world, but it's protecting the oligarchs. It's protecting predatory capitalism. I mean, it doesn't seem like it's protecting jobs and having people have health care and free education and those things that I believe are necessary.
Mm-hmm.
It's to protect capitalism so the very few can make a lot of money.
Well, that's the... that's the consequence of what we did, has been to create a pinnacle where there are a few people at the top who own, maybe 70 or 80% of the capital in this country is in the hands of the top 1%. So you've got that the beginning of the income inequality surge, which starts in the mid-1970s. Through the course of the golden years from 45 to 75, income inequality was actually more moderate, and it really picked up steam after the golden years were over in the middle 1970s. And if you remember back in those days, we had a progressive tax rate at the federal level, 90-some percent.
Very, very high.
Yeah.
Yes.
On the,
and we,
the super
and we prospered.
Rich. Yes. Yeah.
And we did prosper. And I guess when Reagan dropped it way down, he had to reverse that later on because the deficit was increased mm-hmm. so much. And mm-hmm. there were major problems, I mean, with
yeah.
debt.
Yeah.
And Professor Pollack, I think we should take a short break,
yeah.
right now, if that's okay with you. And we're going to listen to Bob Wickline about taking our heads out of the sand. I think that's a great idea.
I had a dream the other night. Now, in my dream, our national bird had become the ostrich. How much can she take? How much can she give? How much is too much, and how much longer can she live? As we turn our backs and turn our eyes and pretend we don't see. If ignorance is bliss, then full of bliss are we as we take, 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 take. Like a good mother, Mother Nature keeps giving, but her heart must be ready to break. She's being abused and overused by her children who choose to ignore. There's only so much that she can give before she can give no more. Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. We poison the air, we poison the land, and we poison the water we drink. And we're the only known creatures in the whole universe with the ability to think. But we keep on thinking, happiness lies in how much we buy and sell. And more of paradise is lost, and only time will tell what will become of Mother Nature in the coming years. When we will have about 10 billion neighbors on this sphere, will our children's children wake up to the American dream? Or will it have become a nightmare beyond imagining? Let's take our heads out of the sand and open up our eyes. Let's take our heads out of the sand and finally realize that our tomorrows will depend on what we do today. Let me not greed lead the way. We use so much and waste so much. How much do we really need? And how long can a dream survive that seems to thrive on greed?
Welcome back to Dig This Trump Watch with Professor Parker Pollack. We have been talking about what? The time of greatness, the era of greatness, Trump's let's make America great again. And when we talk about that, we've been investigating who is it great for? What does this mean? Looking at the different time periods. And that is where we left off. So, Professor Pollack, where would you like to go now?
Well, I think we could probably close out that part or that topic with the comment about what is President Trump, if that's the period that he'd like to go back to when he thinks we were great, if you take a look at his foreign policy attitudes, they're not that far off from some of the foreign policy attitudes, although they weren't out in the open the way he is. He's blustery and, you know, the bullying kind of guy.
He's a bully. He's just a bully.
But we had, during that period, starting in 1953, if you went from 1953 through the golden years, we deposed or we changed the leaders in other countries 16 times. And certainly it was that idea that we were developing an attitude where we had to protect the world. We were going to be the giant that would confront the Soviet Union wherever they showed their ugly face. And as I mentioned before, it cost us dearly in social programs we could have had in this country. We could have had a situation with a pupil-teacher ratio in K-4 and kindergarten through fourth grade of 5-1. I mean, if you want to take a look how to do K-4 education, we're going to have to talk about that, but look at Finland. There are some people that have figured out how to do it, and we're not one of them. We haven't devoted the resources. So,
and this is what really troubles me, though, Professor Pollack, you know, about the United States deposing elected leaders and sometimes unelected leaders around the world, and we get upset by the notion of whether it's true or not, Russia meddling in our elections, and yet we go and overthrow Libya, mm-hmm. tried to do it in Syria, Iraq, you know, and then how many times did we try to kill
Panama.
Castro?
Seven that I know of.
I thought it was like hundreds of times.
It could have been. Well,
I don't know. And then Allende. And so then mm-hmm. you have these warmongering military guys in power that are totalitarian. It's just awful. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. that we do that right. under the guise of what I think it's under the guise of capitalism and keeping capitalism as the economic system around the world to have more countries buying our products.
Well, it does. Yeah. Part of the dilemma, if you went back to 53, when we Iran had just elected Mossadegh to be the president. The monarchy was replaced by a democratically elected leader.
Yes.
England didn't like it because one of the things Mossadegh was suggesting with their parliament was that the nation's people should benefit from the oil
yes.
underneath the soil of Iran. And so England was going to see their oil, maybe it was British Petroleum, but at any rate, a British oil company was going to have to leave town. They're going to be bought out. It wasn't like they were going to be all, you know, just run out of town. But so England and the Eisenhower administration got together, rounded up a couple of guys, one with a very famous name, not the same one, but Schwarzkopf, and a Roosevelt. Anyway, sent them over there, and they engineered the overthrow of Allende with a certain amount of money paid to people there to conduct the overthrow.
Mossadegh
or Allende?
Pardon, Mossadegh.
Mossadegh.
Yeah, in Iran. And so then here comes the Shah back. The monarch
yes.
returns to power in 1953, and for 25 years, he's our guy. He's our puppet. And the people in Iran, they knew that. We had students here in Shasta County, college students here, from Iran, and they were the first ones that let me know what our country did to their leader. One day after class, three of them had said, "Did I know the name Mossadegh?" I said, "No." He said, "Well, you guys killed him. It wasn't that we killed him; we overthrew
right,
him."
Right.
So, at any rate, the Shah came back for 25 years. He was the guy until finally they overthrew the Shah, sent him packing. Came to the United States eventually,
yeah.
And they took hostages there in our embassy, thinking that was the only way they were going to keep American jets from strafing and ruining killing a lot of people. So they thought that, which hostage taking is an old art, or
right.
common practice, I guess. But that was the reason. So they held the hostages for a year, a little over a year, until Reagan got elected, and the day of his inauguration, they let him free.
And he had worked something out while Carter was president. Is that not correct?
Well, the rumors really flew about that one.
Yeah. And something else that you mentioned about the oil and, you know, Mossadegh and having it for the people, it would appear a very similar thing happened in Venezuela with Hugo Chavez, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. where he wanted to nationalize. He wanted the oil companies, corporations out. He wanted to educate the people, use the money from their oil to help the people. We seem not to, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. we seem to want the U.S. corporations in these countries, which is very sad.
We may have mentioned this fellow before, but Smedley Butler is the most decorated Marine in the history of the United States Marine Corps. And Smedley, Congressional Medal of Honor, and when the Marine Corps was issuing their own Medal of Honor, he received that one as well. And he was the leader of our efforts in Latin America to make sure that American corporations had access to the land. That meant the peasants had to be forced off the land into the cities so that they could grow coffee beans and bananas, cash crops, none of which feed people, which is what the indigenous people were doing with the land, was growing crops and eating and surviving and doing rather well. So Smedley Butler and the U.S. Marine Corps made sure that the peasants were kept at bay. And he finally quit and said, "I got tired of being a thug for capitalism." And he has a book out called War is a Lie. And he passed away in 1940, but he finally gave it up in 1933. He retired from the Marine Corps. He had done this all the way through the 20s, and he just got sick of it. Go ahead.
Well, Professor Pollack, let me ask you this, because when obviously corporate media does not talk about this, and very similarly in Iraq, and whether Saddam Hussein wanted to unhinge oil from the dollar and, you know, do it differently, and what's happening in Syria and what's happening in various places. But if we talk about these things, it's like, what? We're seen as what? I mean, does this make us traitorous? Does this make us progressive? Why do we get only the other side of pro-capitalism rather than all of these things that we mm-hmm. have done in our mm-hmm. history? Mm-hmm. And now where we are, we have this huge bloated military, and people are being taxed to death, and the jobs and not having decent jobs, and a lot of inequality. How do we get the word out, and then the attack on academia on top of it? Because if we are arbiters of truth in certain ways about teaching young people, you know, critical thinking skills, this is how you evaluate truth, facts, and so forth. I mean, is that part? I mean, that's what Joseph Stiglitz was mm-hmm. intimating mm-hmm. in a mm-hmm. way. Right. It's another assault on academia by having this tax reform, this proposed tax reform that graduate students have to do what they have. They're supposed to, if they get a tuition waiver of $50,000 and they're working minimally for a stipend with $30,000, they're supposed to pay taxes now on $80,000.
They're supposed to, yeah.
And that stipend was just to keep them going.
Right. And endowments are being taxed. So this is, and graduate students are saying, my goodness, we're just barely scraping by. I mean, I remember when I was in school and mm-hmm. how difficult that mm-hmm. is. So where education can help students think, become wiser, become better citizens, or more critical thinking citizens, we're going to somehow we're going to make that more difficult too. It just bothers me.
Well, if you went back to 9/11, September 11th, 01, after the attacks on the planes crashed into the buildings there in New York City, there was a lady by the name of Lynn Cheney, who was the president of the School Boards Association, and her husband was the vice president.
Yes.
And she started a blacklist.
A list of college professors,
right? Yes. And I was upset that I was never on the list, but she was listing everyone who should be on the blacklist who was being critical of the United States
and their policy.
Providing some perspective on what were these guys up to. They were well-educated in the West, to a man, of the 19 guys who flew the planes. They may have been driven by religion, but they were also upset with the fact that the United States had run amok over the Middle East.
Yes.
And if you wanted to have students take a look at our role in the Middle East over the, well, since the Ottoman Empire collapsed in 1920, Lynn Cheney and some people from her way of thinking, that's subversive. You can only teach things that make people feel good about their country. This is what happened to our friend Dean Hinshaw when he got out of Stanford, went to work in the Sacramento Valley at a high school teaching history.
Yes.
The department head told him, now, Dean, don't get carried away here. Just make them feel good about their country. And that's popping up again. There's an effort now, a movement's beginning again, to make sure that we teach something called patriotism. So we've got the flag and the pledge and the song, the anthem. Mm-hmm. And if you have those things instilled deeply into little children's minds, then they'll have, so this thinking goes on the people who want to teach patriotism, So the thinking goes, you will further ensure that when it comes time to go to war, they won't question. Mm-hmm. And the way, if we're going to have to fight more than one war at a time, we have to have more troops. And in order to have more troops, we have to have women getting pregnant and having more babies. And the women can't be educated, because educated women don't have lots of babies. So you need to keep women dumb and pregnant, and then you can have enough soldiers to go off to war.
And corporations and businesses shouldn't have to pay for birth control, right?
Right.
Oh, yeah, my goodness. Yeah. And so the world's population, mm-hmm. what is it? It's over 7 billion now. Mm-hmm. But I think that is so fascinating, and it's so sick.
Mm-hmm. Right.
In my opinion.
And it helps if you have an unemployment rate, 4.4, 5 point, whatever the real rate is, could be closer to 10.
Oh, I think it's way more than that, quite honestly, because if you look around at how many people are homeless, then it's clear that they're not counted as unemployed.
No, that's
but
right.
They are unemployed, and there's so many of them.
Right.
That, no, it's got to be really hot.
And you've got
hot.
The underground economy, too.
Yes, yeah. Yes. It's very hot.
Sure. So you need an unemployment rate that's up around 18 or 19%. And the only way you can do that is if you don't have a really adequate education program, including government-paid college tuition, so that you'll have excess labor to go into the military to run the programs. And so the idea of what Smedley Butler was doing to control Latin America, mm-hmm. we're still doing that.
Yes.
It's just that we don't send the Marines down there anymore. We bring the soldiers from Latin America to
School of America type things.
Yes, School of Americas.
On your T-shirt, I see School of America. But it's called something else now. What is it called?
Oh,
I forget.
The Western Hemispheric School of something or other. But it's still, if listeners want to check it out, just type in, Google in School of Americas. So we bring them here. We teach them how to control their people so that the corporations from Europe and the United States, Germany has money invested in these efforts. The program is still going on. It's just that we don't send the Marines down there to do it, to control the people. We bring the soldiers here and teach them how to control their own people.
And, you know, one thing I want to say about media, and this is one reason that I love community radio, is that on corporate media, you're not going to hear shows like this. There's an agenda, and it goes back to how we're going to portray the U.S. in the world rather than the truthful history of how we have been in the world. And so, Professor Pollack, I am so glad you're here, and I'm so glad that you are reminding us economically and historically and politically how we have lived our lives over decade after decade, century after century, because we have this historical amnesia. Mm-hmm. And until hope in that way, but I was thinking until people become more awake in order to make changes to help people, to cooperate, to work for the common good, to have health care and free education, all of these things that would make our lives better instead of a war machine that, creates suffering and death all around mm-hmm. the world and mm-hmm. hate.
Yeah.
I don't get it.
Well, let me back up. I don't think there's any country in the world, maybe except Luxembourg, who can show their foreign policy to the rest of the nations in the world and be proud of it. If you look at what France has done over the years, or what England's done over the years, what Germany's done over the years, what Russia's done over the years, it's ugly. A country's foreign policy, the things that stand out about it are the things that are so important to that country alone to protect its own interest in the world. And I think Donald Trump is falling into that trap.
So why couldn't we be a model of something different, mean, that other countries might want to emulate in a very healthy, positive way?
Mm-hmm, sure.
Well, in terms of green energy, in terms mm-hmm. of peace, Trump also and his cabinet, did away with the Institute of Peace or the Federal Institute of Peace? I mean, this is just, to me, is totally incredible.
Yeah, yeah.
So we are a war machine.
Well, they're... The secret, the three of us, the secret we all know is education. What you have to do is have a golden form of education, let's say. You have to have a situation where, and we can get to this later, because there's a way out of this mess that I don't think Donald Trump has discovered what it is yet, because he's shown, at least I haven't picked up any evidence that he understands the current mess we're in after the golden years.
Well, I think he's so self-absorbed that...
He doesn't really care.
He doesn't want to take in that new information.
No. Mm-hmm. Good. Well, at some point, I think we probably should get to his obsessions, maybe next program or...
Well, since we only have 5 minutes left, it's going to take a long time to talk about.
Well, you know, I was Pamela and Professor Pollack. He's now saying that the Access Hollywood tape was not really his voice, and that was faked. Despite the fact that he apologized at the time for what he'd said there when that was revealed. And now I guess he's reintroducing the birther idea that Barack Obama was really not not really born in the United States. He was not a citizen. So this guy is a Looney Tunes, and we have him in charge of our nuclear arsenal. And it's like Bob Corker, Senator Corker said, it's truly frightening. I just don't know where this all ends.
Well, if you took a look at North Korea, for instance, one of the things that I think Mattis and Tillerson and McMaster and Kelly, the four guys are closest to the president, who earlier today, was described as a madman on MSNBC. Lawrence O'Donnell was interviewing and talked to somebody, a notable person, who thinks we have a madman in the White House.
A famous psychiatrist. Maybe was that was it. About that.
Yeah. So you've got this. What would it be? A process for trying to figure out how we would stumble into a war with North Korea, and it probably would be over something that would happen, and we'd take out one of their ballistic missile sites, and they get upset, and then they start a war with South Korea, and then we're into it big time.
You know, I would really like to, since we have about 3.5 minutes left, if next show, which would be next month, be able to talk about North Korea and also tax reform and also Trump's state of mind, because... I've been just making a note of things that he's doing, appointments that he's making, saying one thing one week and then doing a turnabout the next week. No, I didn't say that. I said this. I said this. No, I didn't say that. It's like, and part of it, I wonder if it's a distraction just to keep everybody just all, concerned, and they can just go out and do these things. I don't know. In the world, I don't know.
There's some.
I don't think he's hinged to the truth. I don't think he's hinged to truth.
There's some similarity between the way he governs and the way Putin governs. And we talked about Putin having an adhocracy that's full of ambiguity with plausible deniability. Well, I think inadvertently, I don't think he designed it because I don't think he's got that sort of a mind, but inadvertently Donald Trump has developed the same sort of governing skills, in my view, that Putin has, that he lets other people go off and do things and they earn favor with him. And then they proceed, and we probably should, when we get to one of the obsessions, it's going to be an obsession with Russia that I'd like to spend some time talking about, especially what happened today when Flynn has now copped a plea. He's pled guilty to lying to the FBI, and Mueller's got a Mr. Dean from the Nixon years. We now have a new Mr. Dean.
And I'm wondering if this is kind of a tightrope that we have to walk, because on one hand, if we think about the McCarthy era and red baiting and Russia as a scapegoat and the enemy, we love to have enemies, and at the same time, the truth about what's happening in Russia is almost like, there are different sides to this, a fine line that I think, in my opinion, how we're going to negotiate that, because it really is... a mystery. Mm-hmm.
Well, next year, Putin will be up for election. Navalny looked like a contender. We'll see what happens. Yeah.
Well, is there anything else that you would like to end with? Because we only have about a minute and a half left.
We could go back to some of the great things that happened in a prior month. We had these lists from other months, and we never got to them. Do we have about 20 seconds?
Okay.
Well, past Novembers, Nat Turner was hanged in 1831 in a prior November.
Nat Turner, yes.
The slave revolt.
Yes.
Susan B. Anthony was arrested for voting in 1872. Jean Debs, a socialist, got 900,000 votes for president while he was in jail. Wilson locked him up under the Espionage Act during World War I. Hormel workers won a sit-down strike in 1933 in November. John L. Lewis founded the CIO in November. Great guy. Okay.
All right. Thank you so much, Professor Pollack. This was absolutely wonderful. And thank you, Craig, for joining in on the discussion. And I'm Pamela Spoto. We'd like to thank our listening audience. This is KKRN. .org Community Radio, Round Mountain and Bella Vista. Tune in next Saturday for Pearl on Politics with Professor David Pearl. Bye for now.